Well, her day started better than it ended. She came, she saw, she rubbed the collective bellies of the Oireachtas. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was in Dublin today for an address to both houses of the Oireachtas, reminding Ireland what Europe had done for it and what Ireland does and can do for Europe in the future.
We can all benefit from a bit more of the Irish approach to life. And Ireland's future is built on opportunity, optimism, and openness. And Europe needs this positive vision for a competitive economy, for a green, digital, trade-oriented European Union, with a global role reinforced by Ireland's strong links across the Atlantic and with the English-speaking world.
There wasn't quite as much opportunity or optimism for Hansi Flick, the manager of Ursula von der Leyen's national football team today, Gabby, but why was she here and what did she say?
She came, she saw and she conquered, I think, the Oireachtas certainly today. Yes, so she came over for her visit. She went into government buildings. She met the Taoiseach. She was escorted into Leinster House. And she made this, I suppose, really quite historic address, addressing both TDs and senators who come into the Dáil chamber. She's sort of reiterating that, you know, this EU trust in Ireland, and I suppose saying that she really has our back when it comes to the protocol. She's reiterating the call, saying there can be no hard border on the island of Ireland. She's saying, you know, paying tribute to those Irish virtues. She's talking about our passion for freedom. She's even, you know, speaking Beagán Gaeilge, using words like, you know, Saoirse, for example. She's saying how, you know, our people are stubborn and they have this optimism, which we need a little bit of that in the EU. She's, I suppose, paying tribute to how much of a long way the country has come. And she's also paying tribute to our energy, which I suppose the Green Party is probably very happy to hear. She, you know, she's saying how we're using a lot of renewables like wind energy. She's saying that how we're placed economically, that's of advantage to us. So she's being very positive, and I suppose she very much got that back from her own ministers and TDs and senators. There was, of course, a few TDs who did abstain and did not clap, including People for Profit TDs, Richard Boyd-Barrett, Paul Murphy. But I think overall, very much a warm welcome and a warm reception for the president. I think she's the first EU commissioner, female EU commissioner, to make an address. So I think on that alone, even as I sat in the press gallery and she made her speech sort of directly under me, and I was watching the Taoiseach and some of the ministers, I think you could see her own Taoiseach was very much impressed by her. And he was hanging on to her every word. So.
All right. Okay. Well, it was guaranteed to find favour, wasn't it, Neil Richmond, where she was talking in the Brexit part of the speech. At the very least, it was a reaffirmation of European solidarity with Ireland, particularly on the issue of no hard border.
Yeah, it really reminds me of the last time we had a European Commission present here was Jean-Claude Juncker. And the middle of his address, one of the opposition deputies, who's still an opposition deputy, shouted out when they were speaking about the border, "Can we trust you?" And that was reaffirmed really strongly. And I think we all applauded that line. I think the whole House and the gallery applauded when she said quite clearly that the European Commission, the European Union would stand by not just the Good Friday Agreement, but ensure that there's no hard border on our island again. And that's something, you know, going through the Brexit debates over the last few years, people have always said, well, at some stage, the EU are going to throw us under the bus. But they never have. And I was really taken by the speech. I've listened to a lot of speeches from European commissioners, and this one was a little bit different. It was quite fluent, not just in her ability in English, but it was clearly written for an Irish audience, not just the Beagán Gaeilge, but a few of the phrases and the colloquial phrases. It was, I thought it was a very good speech, and it ticked a lot beyond Brexit as well, which is quite encouraging.
Including the Saw Doctors.
Yeah.
I think, Martin, you agree. I think I saw you getting positively emotional when she mentioned the Saw Doctor's Good Western Man.
No, I think, it was clearly a presentation to show that, you know, the European Union is in tune with the needs of Ireland, and particularly in regard to Brexit and the protocol and all of that. I remember that last incident, and I guess, you know, for many people that lived through austerity and all of that, there was a bad taste in the mouth that the European Union had pushed that onto us in the context of that. And I think that's where that came from. But, you know, we have to move past that, and we have to understand that we have to work together, and we are doing so. And in fairness, you know, the protocol is working for business in the north, and it's going to deliver Of course, there's always going to be teething problems in the beginning. Unfortunately, they've been exaggerated into a problem that is trying to close down the whole lot and has actually succeeded in doing so. And I think, you know, the message that the new British Prime Minister seems to be more open to doing a deal was also something that I took positive from her comments. And we hope that we can trust that the European Union negotiators will be able to extract that deal, which will work for everyone, and the DUP will go back into government and get things moving again.
Patrick, do you think he is more open to doing a deal? Because on the one hand, he's talking about better relations and the mood music improving. On the other hand, he's, Rishi Sunak, this is talking about not wanting closer alignment with the European Union. And there are people who are influential voices within his own party who say compromise with one side of their mouth but maintain a hard line with the other. I mean, do we even know where things are at?
Well, I'm not even entirely sure he knows where things are at. Things may be less chaotic now in Westminster, but his own party is very split on the issue of Europe. His own party is very split on the issue of Brexit and how hard it should be. You have the DUP who are deliberately exploiting the situation, I would argue. At one point during her speech, President von der Leyen said, Brexit will not be a bloc to reconciliation. But that's exactly what it has been used as, very deliberately, by some people who want to drive a wedge between Britain and Ireland, who want that hard border. So I think Rishi Sunak is making, as you say, making the right mood music. But really, he's still managing very disparate constituencies within his own party and within British politics. That's going to be very hard for him to keep going. And we've seen with the last few prime ministers over there how quickly things can turn for them with even just one of those constituencies falling apart. And this is why, I just finished this point, this is why it's very important and very encouraging that Ireland and the European Union are standing together, and that we don't allow ourselves to be split, because we will be stronger and get a better deal for everyone in Ireland in that way.
Mood music aside, Neil Richmond, the Taoiseach has said he wants to see meat on the bones of this mood music. And we saw in the European Parliament there yesterday that possible retaliation mechanisms were being discussed. In fact, the European Parliament voted in favour of giving Europe the ability to harden up its stance and take further retaliatory measures if the United Kingdom is to disapply parts of the international treaty it signed with the European Union. I mean, that's all very well and good for the mood music, but it's also anticipating that things could go in an entirely different direction. So,
yeah, you hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And what the decision made by the European Parliament yesterday is a responsible one. But I spent the first two days of the week in London with the European Affairs Committee, and we met Lords, MPs and ministers from all parties, government and opposition, to drill really into great bit of detail down into what the outstanding issues are and where we're at. So without getting too technical or lurching into Euro bubble speak, where we're at is technical notes have been exchanged once again between the negotiating teams. These are officials. And what we hope to see in the next couple of weeks is a political move where Mara Šefčovič from the European Commission side and James Cleverly, the British Foreign Secretary, come together and say, well, what exactly is the outline of the deal? It's quite clear that there is a deal in the offing in relation to the implementation of the protocol, and it will pass through the House of Commons. The British Labour Party have publicly and privately made it very clear that they will back a deal that allows the protocol to work better. The rump that's left in the Conservative Party that bedeviled Theresa May and many others is about down to about 12 or 13 members. I met one of them, had a great ding-dong of a row with him, but the likes of Steve Baker and Chris Heaton-Harris, who previously were very, very influential in this, they're now in the government. They are the people who will be expected not just to deliver this deal through the back benches, but to champion it.
Right. And that's all very well and good, but the DUP, it doesn't mean they would re-enter an assembly in Northern Ireland if it's changed to their satisfaction, regardless of MPs in Westminster vote.
Yeah, it doesn't, and that's, I suppose, the difficulty. But that said, I think, you know, if a deal is negotiated, is secured by the British government and the European Union, you know, the DUP at some point will have to come to accept democracy at the end of the day. And that's one of the difficulties in all of this. The majority of the people of the North didn't vote for Brexit, wanted to stay in the European Union,
sure,
and yet
we find
ourselves in this mess.
But the Assembly is not built on plus one majoritarianism, and the entire dispensation in the North relies on respecting voices that may be a minority voice.
And we could find ourselves in another election situation in the new year. That's a very likely outcome of all of this, regardless of what happens in London and Brussels.
All right. Well, Ukraine loomed large in Ursula von der Leyen's remarks today. She also played up Ireland's role in potentially helping the energy transition. Let's hear from her on that.
You can become a net exporter of energy and help the rest of Europe replace Russian fossil fuel. The new electricity interconnector to France, supported by European funds, will become yet another engine of growth here in Ireland.
So, Patrick Costello, how far are we away from that, in your mind?
I think we're certainly moving towards that much quicker than we had previously. Like, this government has done more in terms of wind generation and wind power and offshore energy than any previous government.
And the existing barriers are what, in your mind?
Well, I think some of the existing, there's lots of structural things that are getting in the way. We've seen some of the offshore wind companies saying that there isn't enough ports here to properly service them, the offshore wind. We've seen difficulties around some of the licensing and the building. We've seen difficulty with recruitment. But all of these issues are being tackled head on, I think, by Eamon Ryan, by Leo Varadkar in terms of enterprise, and we're working to address these. And as I say, we've done more in this government than any government before. And this isn't just about a European issue. This is an existential issue.
And do you think everybody's on board with that, in all parties, in government?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think really the potential for wind power, both in terms of addressing our climate change and becoming a source of energy exports and a source of income to this country. I think most people in the Dáil are really onto this. And you don't hear voices arguing against it. You hear voices arguing about how to do it differently, perhaps. But the general direction of travel is one that's certainly agreed.
OK, that, Neil Richmond, that interconnector with France, the likes of undersea cables, undersea internet cables, does that throw the issue of Ireland defending its coastline into the mix? If we're going to have these big, ambitious projects, does Ireland's defence capability come into question if we're going to have these large infrastructure projects?
It does, to be quite frank, and that's been said by security experts and political leaders for quite some time. I think the first thing to say about the Celtic Interconnector, the final contract that was agreed this week, this is huge. This has been something that's been talked about for the last couple of years. Big funding from the Irish and French governments, crucially 50% funding from the European Commission, where we'll be able to not just take energy from the continent, but crucially in due course to supply energy back in. But undersea cables beyond the Celtic Interconnector have always been a huge part of the Irish coastal infrastructure, for want of a better word. And we have seen in the last number of years very concerning activity over our coasts. We are very lucky, and some people mightn't like to say it, but we are very lucky to have a memorandum of understanding on defence with the United Kingdom since 2015. And we have seen where Royal Navy ships have come in to intercept other ships.
Right. And do you think that's a satisfactory situation? Or do you think Ireland should have that capability?
Realistically, I don't think Ireland alone could have that capability. I don't think we have that size in ourselves to protect a mass of the sea that's three times the size of Germany and has cables stretching that may be direct from the United States to the continent as well as from Ireland to the continent. I think that's where we need to have cooperation on that security, and we need to have greater investment in our own maritime fleet and much more.
Yeah, there's an argument to be made, though, about, and I was with the Taoiseach and Minister Eamon Ryan in Paris when they signed this agreement last week. It's not an argument to be made for, I suppose, we're so against nuclear in this country. We are going to be using nuclear French energy, which will come in from the interconnector. And also, you know, I don't agree at all that all coalition TDs are on board with the Greens. I mean, you're smiling at me there, Deputy Costello, because you know that to be the case. Like, yes, of course, I'm sure there's some elements that they do agree with you. But if you speak to, for example, Fianna Fáil backbench TDs, I mean, they'll tell you that all they hear about in their farming constituencies is farmers giving out about the Greens. They're doing this, they're doing this. They're looking to cull my herd. They're looking to make me pay more tax. And they're not happy with that at all. And I think the challenge for the Green Party and government, as it has been, and I think it will continue to be, is to deliver, but to also keep those rural communities who feel that the Greens don't understand them on their side.
Martin Kenny, you're nodding along with that.
Yeah, I know. It's certainly my experience living in rural Ireland that a lot of people have, you know, a great distrust of green politics because they see it as something that's about taking away something from them.
Do you share it?
And I can understand it more than share it. I think there's huge opportunities in the green agenda. I think there's opportunities for farming. I think there's opportunities for rural communities to be rebuilt.
And what specifically?
Communities like where I live.
Where's the greatest suspicion?
Well, the greatest suspicion, I think, is that farmers see, certainly in my part of the country, the only farming is really suckling cows and, you know, keeping animals on their farms. That's the only options they've got because of the type of marginal land they have. And all they hear about is that the animals are going to be culled. And they think it's them, that's their animals that's going to be culled. It doesn't necessarily have to be. But what I think we need to be able to do is offer opportunity for farmers like that, that there are other ways that they can make money. And if you give them other ways that they can make money, they will embrace that. You know, if the farmers are ultimately the custodians of the land and are the ones that have been there for centuries keeping it right, if they could farm in a profitable way that's, you know, with low intensity and high biodiversity and get a good profit for it, they will do that, and they will do that in abundance across the entire country. But unfortunately, they tune into this sort of a green agenda, which is what they hear is it's about cutting farming, stopping farming,
so,
planting
so just
the
to
land
be clear,
rather than
do,
farming
do the
land.
Do the Greens have the wrong policies or use the wrong language to sell it?
I think it's about this idea of the Greens are a Dublin-based party and that Eamon Ryan only cares about what happens within the M50 and not beyond it. You know, like if you speak to farmers in the country, they'll say, he wants to cull my herd, he wants to take away my diesel car, there's no bus, there's no public transport, really, in rural Ireland. I'm sure, Deputy Kenny, you'll attest to that. I can as well, being from Roscommon. I mean, like, the bus comes, what, every 2 hours? How are you supposed to get around? So I think it's this sort of notion that may not necessarily be true in practice, but that's the understanding that a lot of rural people.
One farmer described
that to
me recently is it's only window box farming that the Greens want to do.
I think, well, first of all, let me just say that.
Defend all that.
Yeah. There's a lot to defend there. But I think I'm able to do it. Like, when I said we're all together, I was mostly talking about just the offshore wind. Obviously, there are lots of things that we disagree on massively in the coalition, that people disagree with the Greens and that the Greens disagree with our coalition.
And you disagree
colleagues
with the Greens, apparently. Well, yeah. CETA, for example.
But, like, I think the important, one of the key things you said there, Martin, was what they hear. And quite often what they hear is not what's actually being said or what's not actually the policy. What you were saying there about how we need, the farmers are the custodians of the land and how we need to find ways to help them so that they can earn money.
So what's the
in
problem?
Biodiverse
they
ways
can't understand
exactly,
or you're not explaining it.
Yeah. I think that there are communication difficulties, but there are, I think, groups who want to exploit that maybe we haven't explained things well and are using that to their own advantage and twisting
the clear,
things
the clear
and who are sending...
Clear, profitable alternatives are not being spelt out to farmers. That's the problem. Clear
do you believe they exist? Or I think they do exist.
And I think if we look
with
at
dairy
what we're
and beef
doing...
Farming.
But if you look at what we're doing in terms of providing solar panel, you know, solar grants to farmers so that they can earn from microgeneration, if incentivizing biodiversity, incentivizing growing of trees and forestry, those sorts of
you're
things. But the sort of stuff you were saying, Martin, is exactly the sort of stuff I say when people ask me about agriculture when I'm out canvassing. What you're saying there is exactly where we're coming from. And now maybe the devil is in the detail and we can get into at the Agricultural Committee. But certainly, like, I don't think you and I are actually very far apart.
I want to go back to the speech that was made today, because Ukraine loomed large in the speech today. But Neil Richmond, it throws up the issue of what Europe is going to do to back up its policy when it sees international law being breached. It's thrown the kitchen sink at the situation in Ukraine. But one of the problems has been the global south, the rest of the world has looked at Europe and said, maybe there's a double standard applying there. What about Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara? What about the building of illegal settlements on the West Bank? Where are the consequences for those countries when international law has been repeatedly broken for decades?
Yeah, that's a very interesting one, especially when you look at the EU obviously being a signatory to the Minsk Accords, which was the international law broken by Russia's most recent invasion of Ukraine. Of course, it's not the first invasion they invaded before in 2014. And equally what the European Commission has done just this week in relation to rule of law within the European Union in terms of holding funding back from Hungary. But the whole area of the rule of law and foreign policy in the EU is one of great difficulty because it is not one where there is unanimity. It is one where there's unanimity and there's always differences of opinion. And you talk about conflicts and global situations, the Middle East being the obvious one, where there isn't a unified opinion in the European Union in relation to what's going on there, be it in the West Bank or Gaza. And that was referred to in great detail by a couple of opposition TDs. And Western Sahara is another one. You can go further afield into ones where the EU have direct impact in terms of what's going on in Tigray and indeed the fall of Afghanistan. And that is a real existential crisis for the EU. I've sat for the last 13 months in the Conference on the Future of Europe, and a lot of people want to talk about, well, if the EU is serious, we have a high representative in foreign policy, but do we want a situation where the EU can actually put teeth into their pact?
Well, part of the teeth in their foreign policy, for example, is you know, their ability to trade, their trading power on that. Would you like to see unanimity being removed then on issues where it comes to voting on trade deals?
Trade deals is one aspect, but unanimity, it covers every aspect. One thing I would like to see at the moment is there are third-party countries that have very lucrative trade deals with the EU who aren't applying sanctions to Russia or are acting as get-arounds for Russia to avoid EU sanctions. That's somewhere we had the European Commission at us in that they have to do work on now.
Martin Kenny, some of your party colleagues were wearing kefayas in the Dáil today in solidarity with the Palestinians. Was that the point they were trying to make?
I think the point they were trying to make was that there's a double standard here when it comes to the European Union around all of these issues. And, you know, I think everyone recognises that and understand that. And in fairness, Neil has spelled it out. You know, there is a problem in that you have a whole lot of different countries that have different foreign policies and different agendas. And trying to iron all those out in the one European Union is very, very difficult.
Patrick Costello, do you think that the European Union, if it has the ability to leverage its trading power on the international stage, it should be using it? And maybe unanimity is a blockage to that.
Well, I think what's missing really is the proper structures at an international stage. Like, we've got the International Criminal Court, but it's bogged down in difficult procedures and a lack of clarity. And if we can use our trading power
veto issue again. It happens at European Union level and it happens at the UN, at the Security Council, where the permanent five can veto it. Yeah. So are vetoes the problem?
I would agree they are, but this is why
rid of unanimity when it comes to trade deals? At agreeing them on a European level when it comes to ratifying?
Well, I think certainly with trade deals, yes. But trade deals, remember, which are a union.
So in the case of CETA, which you're against, if you got rid of that unanimity, but the stance you've taken with regard to having it looked at in the courts would be kind of undermined by that, wouldn't it?
Because
have unanimity for ratifying trade deals.
Because it's a mixed deal. It's a mixed agreement with trade elements and a court element. And the Courts of Justice of the European Union have said where things are a mixed agreement, they must be ratified by the individual member states. So what I'm arguing is that we need proper structures that will enforce the rule of law at an international level. And one of them is the Courts of Justice of the European Union. And if we look at the Singapore trade deal, the trade elements went through and the ICS elements were shelved.
Okay. Neil Richmond, do you think there's going to be any blowback from Patrick's case in the Supreme Court, which has highlighted what the Supreme Court regarded was an important issue of constitutional law in Ireland? Are you detecting any blowback through European channels as a result of certain aspects of CETA being potentially blocked in Ireland?
I think it has to be remembered, firstly, just back to the veto. The veto is very rarely, if ever, used at an EU level. So I think the EU works in terms of getting compromise, and this is another...
But people are leaned on to achieve that compromise. That's also how it works, isn't it?
It's an interpretation, but if we look at CETA, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, I think there's only 16 of the 27 member states have ratified it so far. So we're still at a way, and it isn't just Ireland, and there was a very fierce debate in Germany, for example. I definitely think this is a good trade deal for Ireland in its entirety. I was disappointed with the decision. I fully respect your right to take it and respect the ruling of the court. But it's going to require the government to take a new fresh look to this. And a European approach, I haven't detected any blowback, to be honest.
I think it's an issue for the Greens, not to keep picking on the Green Party. But I think, in fairness, like Leo Varadkar has been quite clear on it. You know, I think he was surprised by the decision of the Supreme Court. I think, you know, Fianna Fáil, it was not a very big issue for them. But for the Greens, it really is. And when you speak to TDs privately, you know, some of them kind of contest, you know, how much big of an issue is it actually? What does it mean to your average Joe Soap? Do they know what CETA is? Of course, it's important for the country, but they probably don't. And I think it's going to be one. And it was actually very clear when the day that the Supreme Court ruling came out, because Taoiseach and Tánaiste had very clear statements. They're saying we're not going to need a referendum, but maybe we can change the law. Whereas Eamon Ryan came out and he said we're going to have to read the ruling, the decision in full. We're going to have to think about it. So he didn't talk about a referendum. Yeah. He didn't talk about changing the law. He's very much now taking his time to, I suppose, get legal advice, get political advice, and to see how to keep all of his party on board with it.
Martin Kenny, do you want to see a referendum?
Well, I think a referendum is probably what's going to end up having to happen. I think in a broader issue, there's an awful lot of countries are members of the United Nations, and we have, the Sustainable Development Goals. And if we look at all of those and we compare them to what we have in a lot of the trade deals that's happening around the world, they would certainly not be compatible, because when it comes to workers' rights, when it comes to women's rights, when it comes to issues about poverty, issues about climate change, issues about keeping our oceans free and clear, all of those things would be breached by many of the trade deals that we enter into. And I think, we can't be serious about protecting our environment and protecting our civilized society, and at the same time be entering into trade deals with countries and economies that have no regard for those things. And I think there are issues there that are broader than just CETA, but they are issues that we need to be looking at overall as a global community as to how we intend to move forward. Because I don't think we can continue to be doing trade deals with whether it's beef from parts of Latin America, which is cutting down the rainforest to produce it, or it's oil from Saudi Arabia or whatever it is. We need to have, a moral standard around those issues, but we also need to have an environmental standard around
them. So we should have a referendum for every trade deal that Ireland's entered?
Well, possibly that's one of the things we could do. I mean, there's some countries that have referendums for an awful lot of things.
If we look at it, Martin, you're talking about the EU has 195 different trade deals. They're all different ways. This trade is going to happen anyway, and the whole point of trade deals is you move trade onto your terms. That's best beneficial, not just economically, but fits into your closer to your values when it comes to addressing climate change, when it comes to workers' rights and all these other things. If anything, these trade deals are the key to bringing up those standards in a global environment. And I'd be highly reluctant.
I accept that.
But I think that's important to say. And I'd be highly reluctant if we're going down the route of putting every trade deal to a referendum. Do we put the finance bill to a referendum?
But
a budget?
Once the trade deal is signed, the ability to use any of the provisions in that trade deal or sort of give people lesser treatment through the means of sanctions once those trade deals are signed, that's constrained without
It depends what's in the trade deal. It depends what's in the trade deal. And if you were agreeing high standards without which the beneficial
to the agreement once that's signed in the
but
trade deal?
But there are plenty of ways of holding people to agreement without creating investor courts. There are lots of state-to-state.
No, I'm not talking about the investor courts. I suppose when are there consequences when a trade deal is signed? If somebody has favourable treatment from the European Union, when are the consequences introduced if the terms of that treaty are breached?
Well, I think first of all, the simple answer is, the technical answer would be, look, that depends on what's in the agreement. However, if we look at how things work in practice, we see that these consequences don't come in, because we've got the Euromed agreement, we've got various trade agreements with Israel, all of which are built on respect for international law and include stuff around respect for human rights and respect for the Palestinians. And we see that breached almost daily and no consequences for it.
Well, we do see consequences, Patrick, because 3 years ago there was massive sanctions taken against Trump's America, for example, in relation to unfair practices for steel protection.
That was tit for tat trade issue on an issue of international law.
We're
on the verge of buying gas off Israel at the moment in Europe.
And the terms of that will state what are the terms of the trade deal, because each trade deal is different that the EU does with every entity. There isn't a copy and paste. CETA wasn't the same as TTIP, that isn't the same as the New Mexico trade deal, which is a refreshment to one that's 20 years old. And they shouldn't be. And that's what I mean. So the gas deal with Israel probably won't have the same conditions that, say, a trade deal with Mercosur might have in if it was ever to come about.
All right.
Should they not have a mechanism of ensuring that there are standards and that there is a means of applying those standards? And that's the difficulty that
almost cutting Ireland off from maybe huge trade deals that, okay, maybe they are maybe a little bit morally questionable, or perhaps you have to have some leniency.
I know, you may have to go a distance to bring somebody the other distance.
Benefit of the country, I suppose, in the long term.
Yeah. And trade will always happen, be it under WTO terms or base terms.
At the moment, the balance is tipped the wrong way. That's the point I make.
Okay. All right, well, we're going to be back with the protests outside centres for people who are seeking international protection after this.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.